Mr. Knott?
Yes.
Can you hear me clearly?
Yes.
Can you state your full name and ABC number for the record, sir?
Samuel Elisha Knott, 84838.
Thank you, sir. You're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency for a 31412A parole hearing to consider regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest. Let me just do a quick double check on that.
Right,
just want to make sure. I'd like to introduce you to the members of the board conducting the hearing with you today. If you can see on the teleconference screen, to my far left at the end of the bench is the Honorable Mr. David Neal. After him is the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson. At the center of the bench is our esteemed board chairman, Dr. C.T. Wright. My name is Louis Quinones. I'll be serving as the panel chairman for your hearing. I will begin your hearing with a summary. Mr. Samuel Knott is 48 years old. He was certified eligible by DOC for 31412A, regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest. Crimes, first-degree murder, kidnapping, and theft occurred on or about March 9, 1990. He was approximately 19 years old at the time of said offenses. Mr. Knott, so far does this sound correct?
Yes.
Okay. On February 28, 1991, he was found guilty by jury trial. On March 29, 1991, he was sentenced to life imprisonment for murder plus 10 years for kidnapping and 5 years for theft, the latter two counts which have since expired. His conviction was appealed and upheld on April 22, 1993. Mr. Knott has been parole eligible since March 22, 2015. It should be noted that Mr. Knott has a prior criminal history that included several arrests and a misdemeanor conviction for shoplifting. Mr. Knott was also a suspect of a conspiracy to commit murder, kidnapping, and armed robbery out of Florida at the time of the instant offense. I will read a summary of the current offense in question. On March 9, 1990, Mr. Placek, John Paul Hartley Jones, and Mr. Knott received a ride from Chad Butcher. While Mr. Butcher was driving, Mr. Knott pointed a gun at him and told him to pull over so John Paul Hartley Jones could drive. During the entire encounter, the victim was told that they were going to rob him and leave him in the desert, but he was repeatedly assured that they were not going to kill him. They drove to an isolated desert location near Sacaton where Thomas Placek, John Paul Hartley Jones, and Mr. Knott led the victim at gunpoint approximately 300 yards into the desert. At that location, they shot and killed the victim. The co-defendants covered the body with brush and left in the victim's car. They were apprehended a couple weeks later when an insurance claim was submitted on the car that belonged to the victim. During a post-Miranda interview, Mr. Knott admitted to participating in the murder of Chad Butcher. Additionally, Mr. Knott admitted that he had committed a similar murder in Florida by stabbing an unknown man in order to steal his car approximately 2 months before the murder of Chad Butcher. And that is a summary of the offense. According to Mr. Knott's institutional progress report, he has had considerable programming and a detailed release plan that includes family support, finances, halfway housing, and potential employment. He's had a limited disciplinary history in DOC from 1992 through to 2008, with his last major on May 7, 2004, which has been quite some time, and we commend you for that, for possession or manufacturing a weapon. I'm sorry, did someone say something?
No, he just said, pardon me.
I'm sorry, there's a little bit of a sound travel issue, and I thought it was coming from the boardroom. Pardon me, sir. So for possession and manufacturing of a weapon. This is his fourth hearing before the board. He has numerous letters of support from his family and friends, but there are also numerous letters from the victim's representatives opposing parole. It should be noted that we have a letter dated October 6, 2017, from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office opposing Mr. Knott's parole. Mr. Knott, this is your first time before most of the members of this board. We'd like to get to know you. In your own words, can you tell us about the crimes that resulted in your incarceration, sir? Oh, hold on 1 second. There's an incoming phone call. I want to make sure it's not a representative.
This is not a representative.
Okay.
Please go ahead.
Okay, pardon me, sir. If you could, Could you tell us in your own words about the crime that resulted in your incarceration?
The crime that resulted in my incarceration started in 90 when I lost custody of my daughter in California. I went back to Iowa to get my life together, started working multiple jobs, acquired some money to save up so I could go back to California to continue fighting the custody of my daughter. At that time, I was living in a trailer with one of the defendants, John Paul Hartley Jones. I told him I was going to go back to California to continue the custody of my daughter, and he asked if he could go with me. At that time, I told him no, but he assured me that he had a way of acquiring some money so we could get some housing and get started with beyond what I had already saved up. So I said yes. When we left Iowa, we ended up in Florida because he told me that's where he had to go to acquire the money. At that time, the car broke down, and we decided that we were going to try to get it fixed, but we didn't have sufficient funds in which to fix it because the money he was hoping to acquire had not come in. So we were going to go rob a street-level drug dealer at that time to try to get some money to continue to fix the car, leave Florida, get back to California. At that time, we ended up getting a ride from a gentleman, and this gentleman, in turn, was wrapped from around the back of the neck while driving down the road by one of my co-defendants, pulled over to the side of the road. We took him into the wooded area. When we proceeded to get him out of the car, we had cheap handcuffs that we were going to handcuff him to a tree. And he somehow ended up getting a hold of a knife, and it turned very bad at that moment. When it was done, the victim was still alive, and I was able to get him into the tree line. Instead of handcuffing him to the tree, I told him to sit there and wait until the moment in which we were gone to go seek help. We left, went, picked up the others, and continued to Arizona. When we went to Arizona, the car broke down, and I was arrested in Pecos County, and I had to wait for possession of a knife charge. I waited. The people I was with left. When I was done seeing the judge on that charge and he released me, I then called my mother, went back to Arizona, at which point I had come to find out that the people I had been with had already gone to Arizona ahead of me and were waiting there. Now, we had no car, so we started looking for work, started seeking day labor, started looking for any kind of work, even went down to a local carnival that was housed in Arizona seeking work, and we couldn't find any work. It was suggested that we acquire a gun and rob a drug dealer again. I don't know why I did it. I knew it was wrong. We'd already done it once. I mean, what kind of custody could I possibly have of my daughter if I'd gotten arrested for the prior crime? But being young and being very stupid, I saw no real immediate way out. I was late for a court date for the custody of my daughter. I don't know. It doesn't make sense. It really doesn't. But I ended up going out with him, and we went down to Golf and Stuff at Metro Center. And while they were looking around, Jared Butcher was brought over and introduced to me and told that we had a ride to go where we wanted to go. We got into the car. A gun had been acquired at that point. I had possession of the gun, hoping that I could maintain control of that so that nothing further would go on and it wouldn't have a repeat of what had occurred the first time. Unfortunately, Chad Butcher had a gun in the back of his car. It was a 22 long rifle. The individual who joined us in the back of the car found the rifle. We gave him out to the desert. Mr. Chad Butcher actually asked me if he could have his inhaler because he had a bad asthma problem and he was having problems breathing. I got him this inhaler. I allowed him to grab his coat because it was kind of chilly that night. And we took him out and I told him that just wait right here and we'll drive off and we'll leave. At that time, a couple of gunshots rang out and he fell to the ground. And unfortunately, that's how I ended up in this situation.
Okay, sir, it's important to say in these parole hearings, and we're not here to retry the case, also in the interest of the integrity of the board, we don't discuss these cases before we come into the hearing room to hear a parole case. But I do have some questions to at least understand so that we can make an informed decision. One is, you said you came into the possession of a firearm. Was there more than one firearm, or are we talking about just the rifle?
So we came into the possession of a 25 handgun.
From?
A small caliber 25 handgun from an individual that we had met in the hotel. We at that point turned around, and that's what we were using. Chad Butcher, however, unbeknownst to us, had a 22 rifle in the back seat of his car at the time in which he gave us a ride.
Here's what's concerning me. I feel that ownership in what you're telling me about the crime and your role in it. But the way it was written in the pre-sentence report or in the summaries from the criminal justice side is that you were the leader, that you gave the order to shoot Mr. Butcher.
Yes, that did come across as that in the courts. However, the reason that came across in the courts, as it was explained to me by my attorney at the time, was I was the oldest male out of the group. There were two females that were also my age. There was two individuals that were 17. They were both emancipated adults. And there was a younger female in the group. But because I was the oldest, my attorney said that they were going to automatically find me to be the leader of this organization. And there's no organization involved. I wasn't leading anybody. Like I said, when I got arrested in Texas, I was sitting in county jail by myself. The five picked themselves up from Texas, got themselves to Arizona, and managed to survive for several weeks out here on their own with no leadership or no say-so from me. So I wasn't expecting them to be in Arizona. They had all stated they wanted to go to California.
Do you recognize your part in this murder, sir?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I could have put him into this at any given time. I could have driven away from Florida. And at that point, by getting on a bus or hitchhiking, I could have stuck my thumb out, I could have left. There's no reason in the world why I should have done what I did. I could have said something to somebody, I could have done something, I could have just wandered off, I could have just left. There's no reason in the world why I should have done what I did. My concern was my daughter, and looking back on this, I know that how can I possibly say that I'm worried about my daughter when I'm doing something like this, which jeopardized my entire life with my daughter? So, I blew it. I was, I was incredibly stupid. I had every chance to put an end to this. I had every chance to walk away from this. And I made the worst choices I could possibly make, and I didn't even really make a decent choice. So how do I fix it? There's nothing I can do to fix it. That's the problem I deal with every day, is I made a choice that ended up costing a man his life. I could have done something to change that. I could have done something to change that entire concept. I could have put an end to all this when I was in county jail back in Texas for the knife by telling them what had occurred in Laverne, Florida. You know, I was so focused on my daughter and trying to gain custody of my kid that I didn't think that was a problem. That's something I've had to work on over the years, thinking things through before I act upon them.
So having reviewed this, well, before I continue, I did have one quick follow-up question. Where did the gun come from, the 25 caliber that you made reference to, the handgun? Where did it come from?
It came from a pawn shop.
Who purchased it?
I believe I did.
Okay. The thing that I have to consider as one voting board member, and I recognize it's been a long time, it's just something that I don't completely understand in reviewing the case, and that is that to me there was something particularly cruel about telling this individual that you weren't going to kill him. You know, he had a breather, he had asthma issues, it sounded like, and he was killed anyways. I mean, whatever mindset was involved here, there's no justification for some of these murders. All I'm saying is, when you look at a crime and it's like, we're stealing money, we killed them so that we would hide the evidence or whatever, but there's kind of a cruelty factor here. And I guess what I'm saying is, what was that about?
I honestly can tell you the reason we bought the gun was because the crime, when it occurred the first time in Florida, involved knives. I figured that by having the gun, I could take more of a control situation in this next crime, and that way I could handle it. Unfortunately, the gun that was in the back of Chad Butcher's car in his back seat was picked up by another defendant. Had I been able to be the only person with the gun, I would have told them that I had this covered. They could have left, gone back to the car. I would have fired a shot, told them to wait until we were gone, and we would have been gone. But when he had the rifle in the back seat and my co-defendant picked the rifle up and brought it out, I no longer had the only gun. And at that point, we walked him out to the desert. We told him to wait. I looked at the guys. I said, let's go. And that's when the gun went off. And several fired shots were fired after that. And he was dead. I mean, I didn't expect the .22 rifle to be in his car. Again, this is part of not being able to know what you're getting involved with. I had not even participated and not gone this route to begin with, he would have still been alive to this day.
Thank you, sir. I'm going to ask my fellow board members if they have any questions for you. Mr. Johnson?
Sir, I just had one question. I know in the recording, Mr. Quinones asked you about this as being the person in charge, but you were the oldest one there, and it says that you were in control of the money and the direction and things that was going on. Is that true, sir?
No, it is not. The women in the group had the money. They controlled the money. They rented the hotel rooms. They bought the food. They bought the things needed. They were the ones who helped pay for the hospital bill when we took one of the young women to the hospital because she was sick. They handled the money. They had the cash.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Dr. Wright?
No questions at this time, sir.
Mr. Neal? Oh, yes, Mr. Johnson.
So I just have one other question for you, sir. And I do see that you have many, some letters and certificates in here. But, sir, what has changed about you since the time this incident occurred?
I think the biggest thing that's changed about me is I've learned to be able to say no to certain groups and certain people. I've been able to learn to tell people no and not to involve myself in certain aspects of certain individuals, to be able to say no to certain influences that are around me at the time, even at my own detriment at moments, and not involve myself in the things that most people in here involve themselves in. I've also taken a great deal of time to start helping out the youngsters that have come into the system, try to keep them away from certain influences, try to keep them away from joining certain groups and organizations, to try to counsel them to better themselves, to be able to go out and get rid of their addiction and try to work towards that. I encourage them to in turn go out and reconnect with their families for support and for help. I reach out and I make every attempt to help the people in here that are willing to be helped. Some people, unfortunately, cannot, but those that can, I offer my assistance with my prior history and my knowledge on how to avoid things when they can be avoided.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Knott. Mm-hmm. Again, in reviewing your institutional progress report, you do have considerable programming. Again, we commend you for that, and a detailed release plan should this vote, should this board vote for home arrest or regular parole. And again, we noted that you you seem to have walked the walk. When it comes to discipline, it's been a long time since you've had a serious disciplinary infraction inside the Department of Corrections. What I'm going to do now is we have some people on the telephone and some people in the room, so I'm going to ask some of your representatives to approach the podium. First, we're going to go with the people inside the hearing room, and you can decide for yourselves who comes up first, but if you'll come to the podium. State your name for the record.
My name is Lori Wilson.
And I'll say this for everyone right now, because of our docket, certainly we're going to be fair. People have things that they want to say, both on behalf of the victim and Mr. Knott, but... please limit your statement to no more than 3 minutes.
Yeah, I'm going to be real short.
Thank you, ma'am.
To the point. Basically, I'm very proud of Sam for all the accomplishments that he's made in there. He has come a really long way from going into incarceration and accomplishing things that he really needed to as a kid and growing up. Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you for your time, and I actually wanted to also state that Sam has gotten very few tickets the entire time he's ever been incarcerated, which y'all already know because you guys have been talking about it. The last time he's gotten in trouble was a long time ago. He's very humble now. He's had the same job. He's got a lot of stability now. He's had the same job for a long time. When, you know, he just changed jobs to the library. I'm sorry, I'm so nervous. You guys can probably hear my heart right now. But my cousin has had the same job for several years in a row. He just changed to the library, which he absolutely loves because it's with the computers, it's buying books, etc. But I just want to ask the board to, the only way that you can really base him right now is just off the paperwork that you see in front of you and what he's saying, but I can guarantee you that I would not be here if I did not think that he could actually make it out on his own and be a law-abiding citizen. He's got strong respect for, you know, authority, which you can tell by, you know, his past and the incarcerated with the tickets, etc. You know, he's just a very, he's a very different person. He's a very changed man, and I know for a fact that he could make it. I bought him a car, which you guys have a pink slip for from the last time we came to the hearing. I still have the same exact car. We've got him all situated with clothes, stuff like that. I'm not going to enable him, but I can tell you right now, he will be here for him. And if he is able to go to Texas one day and reside there with me, then I will absolutely put him in business. I'm sorry, and I will actually have work for him. I am a real estate agent. I do that full time, and I make a lot of money doing it. I am opening my own Remax next year. You know, I just ask that you guys really just kind of take a look at everything, all his accomplishments through the years of being in there, and not just the paperwork. It's nobody can bring back life, but I can tell you right now, he would never in his life ever take one, and he would never, you know, he will never be back in prison if you all give him a chance. Okay, I appreciate your time.
Thank you, ma'am. I want to say real quick too that I do appreciate your personal sense of accountability, in as much that I think to myself, not to make this about me, but if I had a relative who was involved in a major crime, I wouldn't just stand up for him because he's family. I believe in accountability,
exactly.
And I can sense that in you, and I find that meaningful. So thank you.
I actually was going to be with the FBI or forensics, but I couldn't get over my fear for guns. So that's the reason why I got into the real estate and not that field. But anyways.
Anyways, I appreciate your position. Any questions from fellow board members?
No.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you so much. She's very emotional. I don't know.
You have the choice as to whether or not you want to say something. You're not obligated to. So if you do speak, you have to speak from the podium. What do you choose? Ma'am, we still have people inside the boardroom who are going to represent, and then we'll get to you in a moment, okay?
Okay, I apologize.
No. Thank you, ma'am. All right. Hey, could you state your name?
My name is Joanne Wilson.
Yes, ma'am.
And you know, Congress Museum, I think the highest quality, really colors the region. And Zane used to live with us when he came to California before he lost Crystal. And the Sam that he was then and the Sam that he is now, he's a good man. He's a good man. I'm sorry. You know, we've been self-employed for almost 30 years. We've had our own printing business there. My husband is his uncle and his mother's brother. And I would give Sam a job at heartbeat. And I would trust him with my grandbabies. You know, I love him. I'm sorry.
No. We recognize that these are hearings are emotional. Any questions from fellow board members?
No, thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. We thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. I know I have people representing on the telephone right now, so who wants to speak first on the telephone?
I will, Kate Pollard.
Could you state your name again, ma'am?
Kate Pollard.
Thank you, ma'am. What would you like to share with the board?
I I would like to say that Sam is not the person that he was. He has grown up, he has matured, he has been, he's almost 50 years old. He has desired to make right the wrong the best he can. He has spoken of often of wanting to help young men and do better decision making. He sees the kids that are coming into the prison and he tries to make sure that they understand they've got to make better choices. He has apologized so many times and he has grieved deeply for the things that have happened to all the families that this action the actions have caused to the families, to the children, to the parents, to the entire family. He wants a chance to be able to prove that he can affect life in a positive way. And he wants to be able to step out and do that. And I hope you give him the chance to prove that he has a lot to offer. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. And I'm going to ask my fellow board members if they have any questions for you. Okay, I know you cannot see us, ma'am, but we don't have any further questions from the board. Do you have someone else with you that was going to speak?
I'm going to have to ask my daughter what you said, because I can't understand the question.
What question, ma'am?
The one that you just asked.
I said, is... Was there somebody else with you that was going to speak?
Oh, yes. Give him a pen and I'm Sam Fisher.
Okay, yes, ma'am. If you could state your full name again.
Deborah Ruth McClendon.
And what would you like to share with the board, ma'am?
Well, I'm not sure. This is the first time I've done this. This is actually the first time I've heard Sam tell that story. So, it's a little... breathtaking. I was family at home when I was like in 8th grade and started on my own. But I remember a brother who protected us and took care of us. Sorry, I'm going to cry. Everything that's happened to him is kind of a shock to me. But I've never spoken to him in 25 years or read a letter that didn't end with him having hate or being angry at anyone but himself. Anyway, thank you for your time.
Thank you, ma'am. While you're still on the phone, I'm going to ask my fellow board members if they have any questions for you. I will cross-check right now with my fellow board members. Do we have anyone else on the phone right now?
No, just...
That's all of our victims' representatives. So I'm going to double-check. I misspoke. I meant the inmates' representatives.
Yes.
That's all of the inmates' representatives that we have today.
Yes, sir.
Pardon me, and thank you for that correction. Again, Ms. Moody, I believe we have a statement from a victim's representative, correct?
So my name is Jaquelle Moody. I'm with Department of Correction Victim Services. And I have a statement that I was going to read for the victim in Florida. His name is Chris Bailey. He's been active at every hearing, both for this inmate and the co-defendant. And then Brian's going to read two very short statements from the deceased Arizona victims. It's his parents, I think a parent and a sister.
Thank you, Ms. Moody.
And then just... This is my, I believe, third hearing for Amy Nama, and I feel like the advocate job's a little complicated with this particular case, but I felt it might be an injustice to the victims if I don't mention that at any other hearing, we've never heard of any female group co-defendants or as part of things. Always been very, very clear and no question of the three inmates together, three defendants that took place. Also, at the beginning of this hearing, you mentioned that they were suspects in the Florida case, and it's always been my understanding, and as well as the county attorney's office, that there was no question of this Florida case, yet there were suspects, the same three defendants were suspects in Florida, I'm sorry, Texas. Two incidents that occurred in Texas that they were suspects there because the Florida victim's vehicle was found in Florida around the same scene.
I'm sorry, that was just word choice for what they were at the time. Because I actually did, when I write these statements, I do wrangle with the timeline a little bit. Just in the same way, not to go on and on. But when an individual, say, has a lot of arrests, but no convictions, I don't want to suggest that there were a bunch of convictions when they're just arrests. So, you know, like word choice.
Yeah, I don't know what else we would call them. I understand was some kind of an agreement or something between the prosecutor's office.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
So. Okay, and this letter is just a little bit long, but we've got two short ones, and he is very adamant that I read it. So,
thank you, ma'am.
It is at my request that I be notified if and when either Thomas Placek or Stephanie Lamont is came up for parole. I thank you for the opportunity to share my story. As you can imagine, it brings back our memories and is truly a nightmare. I will once again relive the most terrifying afternoon of my life. This has been difficult to write about, but important to share with you, as I may be one of the only victims that actually survived. On January 26, 1990, I was working in Orlando, Florida, at Universal Studios on the Nickelodeon sound stages installing sound panels. I had just gotten out of work and stopped at the local 7-Eleven to buy a Pepsi for my nearly 1 hour ride home. As I entered onto the access ramp to Interstate 4, I noticed there were hitchhikers. I originally thought there were two guys, as it turned out there were three. I immediately took notice of their general appearance. They appeared to be clean cut and their clothes were clean. I had no problem giving them a ride. The problem was that although I had a station wagon, the back seat folded down and full of tools. I didn't really have enough room to seat four people comfortably. However, I decided if they were willing to squish into the back seat, I was fine with it. This is where the old saying goes, no good deed goes unpunished. I was 30 years old at the time. By the end of that afternoon, I was fairly certain I was not going to live to see 31. You see, Mr. Knott was one of three men that set out that day to initiate and execute a premeditated plan to obtain the vehicle and dispose of the driver. I said premeditated due to these facts. It started with an exploding one load in a cigarette, which can be purchased in a convenience store. That initiated the abduction with prompting Mr. Knott, who was sitting behind me, to wrap some kind of strap around my neck and strangle me while I was driving on the interstate to the point of being dizzy. To handcuffs they used to handcuff me to the three oversized lines they used to stab me 13 times. Without trying to write a book here, I would like to bring to light some facts that I feel are relevant and will help you understand the overall cold-hearted nature and demeanor of these men. My only attempt is an attempt to inform and hopefully aid you in coming to a reasonable and justifiable decision based on some facts. I have included a photo to show you the picture that was hanging from my mirror and the recklessness of this individual. I also attached a picture of most of his stab wounds. This should be in the file from previous hearings. After being rendered powerless due to oxygen deficiency, I was forced to pull over to the side of the highway with a man sitting next to me. I'm sorry, seven men sitting behind the co-defendant with the one in the backseat, who had a large knife held to my side. He told me to pull over real easy or he will cram this knife through me. After a few seconds, I did pull over and my hope was that they would force me out of the car. They did not. Instead, the man, John Jones, who was right behind Mr. Knott, got out of the vehicle, came around to the driver's side door, pushed me into the center of the car seat, and took over driving. Once back on the interstate, I was trying to talk them into taking my car and my money and letting them go. I pointed to a picture that hung from my mirror of my dead wife and my 10-year-old son and my dog sitting in front of the Christmas tree. I explained they need me to take care of them. I basically just continued to beg them to let me go. I was told in so many words that they didn't care about my family and that I had to die. Now exiting from the interstate, they searched for a secluded area to take me. Eventually, they found a power line board that was cut through the woods, and we went approximately 4 to 1/2 mile up and down the hills. Finally, we stopped at a big tree where they claimed they were handcuffed my arms. I assumed, to be assured, there was no chance I could make it back to tell anyone. Upon pulling up to the tree, we got out of the car and began fighting. I was on top of Mr. Mount punching him, and I figured he was my biggest threat since he had a big knife. I thought at first I was being punched in the back by one of the other guys, but when Mr. Knott yelled for his friends to get me off of him, it was explained he was stabbing me. It was at that point I looked at myself and realized my clothes were soaked in blood. I immediately jumped off of Mr. Knott and ran into the woods. It was about 2 minutes and then turned to run alongside the power line by the road. I thought I maybe just hope and pray that they would take my car and leave. That was not the case. They chased me into the woods. Although I was scared and bloody and winded, I ran as fast as I could up down the hills, thinking each time I got to the top of the hill that this would be the last one. I even thought for a minute that I would be able to outrun them back to the paved road, and that's when I heard someone say, go back and get his car and cut him off. As you can imagine, my car dropped. I was thinking this is hopeless. Though I didn't want to, I stopped to rest, and looking back, I still had a pretty good lead. However, I couldn't get rest, so I stopped. They also stopped at that point. Again, I was hopeful that we stared at each other that they were finally leaving him in the woods, and Mr. Mount told me if I was to throw him on the ground, they would leave. I remember thinking I didn't want to throw him on the ground, but it quickly turned into a no-brainer, and I threw him the wallet. Perhaps one of my most terrifying moments of the entire ordeal was the look in his eyes as I went over to one side, never losing eye contact with me, and he said, get his wallet. I tried pleading them with them, saying, you got my car, and my wallet is with me alone. And Mr. Mount explained, I don't know, I'm going to kill you just like I told you I would. To which I replied, I think you probably already have. With that, they began running after me again, and the chase ensued. I decided to run out of the woods, thinking I could cover the road around or open. I went up and down the hill, my heart beating in again, my lips were filling with blood, and I couldn't breathe. But I knew if I stopped, they would surely catch up with me. I went to the top of the hill only to see another hill. Then I heard my car and saw that they were using it to cut me off from going further. I never considered myself a quitter, but I had nothing left. It was getting dark, I think, or worse. My arms and my head were too heavy to hold up. I know that three of them were shooting over me with their own knives. They were shuffling their feet, sidestepping as they danced circles around me. Maybe they thought I'm not going to fight, but at this point I had no fight left, so I just played them. I remember praying, please, Lord, don't let them stab me anymore. They must have thought I was dead or close to it because they didn't stab me again. Instead of leaving me there, they decided to pick me up and place me in the front of the car, driving me back down the power line road. When we stopped, they took me off the hood of the car and carried me into a path in the woods. At that point, they buried me or covered me up. They used branches, leaves, palm fronds, anything they could find nearby until I could no longer be seen. They were done. I heard one say, should I handcuff them to a tree? And I heard my reply was, no, this guy is not going anywhere. And I left all of the really colorful language. I left out all of the really colorful language, but I'm sure you get the gist of it. I struggled many times before to say if I had the chance. I told everyone that I had been past this, and I had been past. I even told everyone I had forgiven them. As a Christian, I must believe I have. That being said, forgiving is one thing, and forgiving is another. Would be needed, not to mention impossible to forget. So the dilemma I find myself faced with is, in as much as I have forgiven them for their actions, do I feel comfortable with them roaming the streets again? I have talked to many people, including my pastor, and I think his advice is best. Pray for wisdom and seek it. I can't say I have accomplished any level of wisdom. What I can say is that after lots of soul searching, I believe I will have to ask myself these questions. Is Mr. not mentally capable of compassion towards another human being, or instead has he come in becoming even more malicious and self-centered to promote self-preservation, considering the enemy environment? If I go away quickly for Mr. Mount to be granted a second chance, could I be 100% confident that he would never harm, or for that matter, kill another human being for absolutely no reason at all, as he had previously? how long is your not functioning in society? By what financial means? If the environment that Mr. Knapp has been living in the past 25 years conducted of healthy change, what steps has he taken, if any? Would I be okay with Mr. Knapp being my neighbor? How could I ask someone else to be okay with a neighbor with his past? All of that being said, there is one thing that weighs heavily on my mind. In a conversation with an Arizona detective during an investigation of the murder of Chad Butcher, he told me there had been other unsolved murders and murders on the highway between Texas, where the woman had been arrested for concealed weapons, and Arizona, where they eventually killed Chad. The detective went on to say they weren't able to positively link these guys, but they felt certain the crimes were in fact related and shared the same MO. The detective also explained to me, I was definitely the lucky one because even though not intentional on my attacker's part, I was the only victim connected to these men to survive. With that, this trip down memory lane brings me to this final conclusion. In my heart of hearts, as to say in my humble opinion, I think all the answers of my previous question are obvious. Perhaps Mr. Mann is a changed man in many ways. Who am I to judge? I choose not to pass judgment. I hope and pray for Arizona State he seeks forgiveness for himself and seeks a relevant relationship with Jesus Christ. As for his possible release, I see Mr. Knapp as much of a threat to society today as he ever was before he was arrested. To be listening to a world of freedom and imagine nothing more than a nightmare for another possible victim, there is with a clear and conscious mind, I ask that Mr. Knapp remain in custody of the state of Arizona. I could have easily made this a much longer letter, but I wanted to show the relevant facts of how I survived and then I met the hands of these men in January 1990. And then he makes himself available to contact.
Thank you, ma'am.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Bilby. I'm a victim advocate with the Arizona Department of Corrections. Today I have a letter from Barbara Butcher, the mother of Chad Butcher, and Michelle Kennedy, the sister of Chad Butcher. We'll start with Barbara Butcher's letter. To the Board of Executive Clemency, it is with a broken heart again that I think about the murder of our son, Chad Isaac Butcher, that was perpetrated by Samuel Mott and others. Chad would have given him the car, what little money they took from him and his personal items in exchange for his life. I do not know if a person that was so hardened by his teenage years is able to be rehabilitated. I believe that Samuel Mott and others moved across country and killed other people that they were never prosecuted for. And I also cry when I think of the man in Florida they hijacked, stabbed, and left for dead. As a family, we would hope that Samuel not be kept in prison for taking the life of our son. Nothing will bring Chad back, but keeping him in prison will prevent him from killing another person, I would hope. Sincerely, for our family, Barbara Butcher and John L. Scott Sequel.
Thank you, sir.
Letter from Michelle Kennedy. To the Board of Executive Clemency, I am writing in regards to the possible parole for Samuel E. Knott. Samuel Knott is responsible for killing my younger brother, Chad Butcher, in cold blood. He kidnapped him, shot him in the back, left his body in the desert, stole his car. I don't care if he's had good behavior in prison. I don't care if any of you think he's rehabilitated. I'm certain he is still a threat to society in every negative way possible. He has shown no remorse for his actions. He should rot in prison, just like he left my brother's body to rot in the desert of Maricopa County. I almost did not send a letter this go-around because of my incredible disgust after you approved the release of the other inmate responsible for my brother's murder, number 84839 Thomas Plazak. Many letters were sent to your review, and my brothers and my parents flew down to Arizona for the hearing. All of this meant nothing to the board, and this killer was released. Justice was not served, and my faith in the system is non-existent. There are not enough years available to satisfy the term Samuel Knapp should remain in prison. My brother was not granted freedom, and neither should the offender that killed him. Make him serve the sentence he was given and die in prison. Chad's friends and family are serving a life sentence without having him here with us. all at the hands of this vicious murderer, Michelle Butcher Kennedy.
Thank you, sir. Commissioner Knott, we've heard from your representatives and the victim's representatives. We're getting close to the end of the hearing. Is there a final statement you would like to give to the board before we go into discussion? I really ask that you don't repeat yourself in the interest of time management, but this is your hearing. And is there anything else you'd like to share with the board?
I have no way in which to apologize to Christopher Bailey. I have made a conscious choice not to reach out personally to him because I didn't want to hurt him or anger him. I would be more than willing to speak with the individual in the future if he would like to talk. I have hoped somebody would reach out so I could speak with him. I've never heard from anybody in 28 years.
Well, sir, if I may interrupt you, I think there are some sort of restrictions within the Department of Corrections rules about contact with victims, but go ahead, sir. I still hear you.
I don't understand what was said earlier about other victims and other people. There were investigations, I know, but those investigations proved that other people were involved and that we were in no way involved in those other crimes. So the crimes that I have done my time for was for the crime against Mr. Chet, Christopher Bailey and Mr. Butcher. I'm at a total loss as to why other crimes would be involved or even mentioned. My heart breaks. I don't have words. I don't know what to say or how to say it. I could have done something. I should have done something to change what occurred, and I did nothing. And I have tried to change my life on that basis. I have to live with that concept every day of my life. And I have made every conscious effort to try to help other people change and realize that they can make those changes within themselves. If given an opportunity, I will make it a point to prove that I can be able to be an assistance to those people who would make those kind of bad choices and reach out and try to help people out there to not make those kind of bad choices to come back and, or even come into here to begin with. I apologize to Christopher Bailey. There's nothing I can say other than I'm sorry. It's totally inadequate. I pray for Mr. Butcher on a daily basis. I ask his forgiveness. There's not much I can say. I leave it to God, and I leave it to the powers. I will never again, hopefully ever, be back in prison other than a traffic violation. I have no interest in criminal behavior. I have made it a point in prison not to involve myself in criminal behavior. I have made it a point to follow the rules and policies of DOC, and I ask you that you consider this and give me the opportunity to prove that I am not a threat to anybody in society, and that I can become a productive member of society and hopefully a help to somebody out there on the streets. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Knott. The board's going into discussion now. It may sound like we're speaking with you, but it is the board discussing the case amongst itself before we come to our individual votes regarding this decision relating to regular parole, absolute discharge, or home arrest. So if you'll just remain on the phone, The board will be in discussion, and we'll get back to you shortly, okay, sir?
Yes.
Board is now in the discussion. Fellow board members, I want to make sure that I account for the whole of this parole case. Certainly, Mr. Knott has done a significant amount of programming. He has a good release plan, or, you know, as one voting board member, I'd say he has a pretty solid release plan. He's been able to stay discipline-free for quite a period of time. On the other hand, I recognize that we're talking about a pretty heinous violent crime, and as I said earlier during the discussion, that there's just something particularly cruel about this case. This is not to say that I'm in any sort of denial that Mr. Knott hasn't pursued rehabilitation inside the correction system or accounted well for himself as an inmate. But I keep returning to the victim and the crime at hand. Before I ask for the input of my other board members, I think the one thing that I'm uncomfortable with, and I look for the wisdom and the input of my fellow board members on this one, is we look at each of these cases completely individually, even in a case that has multiple defendants and conspiracies, felony murder, or 2, 3, 4, 5 people could be charged for the same murder. We have to look at each of these cases individually, and I think there's just, on one hand, an accountability that I'm hearing from Mr. Knott, and then on the other hand, sort of a mitigation. And I'm not comfortable with it. I can't put my fingers on it, but I feel like that there's some holes in the story. So that's why I want to begin the discussion before we come to our vote. And I do look forward to the input and wisdom of my colleagues. I'll begin with you, Mr. Neal.
Well, I tend to agree with what you're saying, and it's just the telling of the story leaves a lot to be desired about what really happened and why. It is especially heinous as far as I'm concerned because the amount of time that the victim was concerned with motivation to live or die, and regardless of the end result, who pulled the trigger or whatever, the young lad died, but it was after a long period of time of thinking he was going to die and trying to talk his way out of it, and that to me is a lot worse than a real quick shot to somebody who doesn't know what's coming. And the idea of there was like 6 people involved in this, and whatever you want to call it, they were a group that was moving across the country supported by crimes. So I'm not at all comfortable with releasing in any manner at this point in time.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Mr. Johnson.
I do understand, you know, what you guys are saying. However, I do think that Mr. Knott's story, just reading the story, is very, very confusing. And just reading the court records that we actually have and who did what, it was very confusing in there as to what actually occurred. However, I do think that Mr. Knott did take responsibility and is taking responsibility for his actions. And he was 21, and I think the other ones were 18 or a little bit younger than he was, and so I would still consider them, you know, although one's an adult, pretty much around the same age. And there's no doubt that this was a violent, heinous crime that was committed, but, you know, my question is, has Mr. Knott reformed himself? And is Mr. Knott capable of going back out in the community, and the likelihood of of not committing any other crimes while he's out and he's released. I think that Mr. Knott would be a good candidate. My concern about Mr. Knott going to a home arrest is that as I went back and looked through all of the letters, and he has a good deal of family support, but everybody's out of state. And I don't know if he's applied for an interstate compact or if that's possible, but all the families out of state that would be actually supporting him, and that's a concern that I have.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Dr. Wright.
Thank you, Honorable Mr. Gowanus. As you probably know, this is my fourth time seeing Mr. Knox and hearing this. Each time you hear something different, you hear something new each time that you sit here and you listen to it and you really understand what happened. I'm not going through a long discussion this afternoon. I think that we just have to ask the question in each of our minds, or in my mind, do I feel comfortable that he is ready to return to society? I think that he's made progress. He's not the same as he was when the crime was committed. I also think that we have to take under consideration the victims in each of these crimes, and we look at them on an individual basis, as you've already stated, Honorable Mr. Gowanus, and I look at this one on an individual basis, and let me just come to a conclusion at this point. Based upon the information that I've heard today, I have no reason to change my vote from where I have three other times, and each time it has been not to release. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Wright. I think we've had a pretty healthy discussion, and I'm going to go ahead and make my motion, and that is that I move to deny regular parole, absolute discharge of home arrest for Mr. Samuel Knott, ADC number 84838. And based on the year of the incident, I would ask for a 1-year set off.
Second.
What is that?
Second.
It's a green.
Mr. Johnson?
I agree.
I'm going to check a set off for 1 year.
A green.
Released tonight. Denied again is for 412A, 411HA, or that is to say regular parole, absolute discharge of home arrest. And reasons for denial: serious and violent offense, loss of human life, serious and deviant offense, trauma to victim, age of the victim, serious bodily injury. History of assaultive behavior. Prior criminal history. Repeat offender. I won't check poor institutional behavior, any recent disciplinary infractions, history of assaultive behavior in the system. He has a good release plan. Good demeanor during the hearing. So again, the motion was carried to deny regular parole, absolute discharge of home arrest with a 1-year set off. It was carried, and again, the reasons for serious and violent offense, loss of human life, serious and deviant offense, trauma to the victim, age of victim, serious bodily injury, history of assaultive behavior, prior criminal history, and repeat offender. Is there anything else that any fellow board member wishes to add? That being stated, Mr. Knott, did you hear our motion?
Yes.
Do you have any questions? Because this hearing is about to come to conclusion.
I do have one question.
Yes, sir.
I've been to four boards, Four times I've been told that due to the heinousness of the crime, the loss of life, and the victim's family and friends' statements, that I've been denied to the board. I understand that there are other circumstances that you all consider, and I understand that and accept it. How can I go about changing the three that I mentioned to better my chances for proving to the world that I am no longer the person I was at that time, and that I am incapable of change, and I have shown that change through my behavior and my actions in prison? What can I do to assist myself in showing the board this?
Mr. Knott, all I can say is that each time you come before this board, the case will look at the totality of your parole packet and will make their individual decisions as to where you've evolved or arrived at that time. And I don't think there's anything else I can say. Dr. Wright?
All right, thank you.
Well, you said it,
yes, sir. Okay, this hearing is concluded. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.